Okay, page 49. Upaya Bhakti has its parts. One, intent devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And two, renunciation of the material world. Summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary. This Upaya Bhakti alone is the resort of the conditioned souls. Right? Means the constitutionally situated souls don't require it, because there's no renunciation of the material world. It's just cultivating one's attachment or attraction to Krishna. The cultivation of divine love is the activity or the blissful inclination of the transcendental jivas. The renunciation of the material world is the reformative upliftment of the jivas from the dirt of worldliness. Right? Natural state, you're cultivating the love, but in the conditioned state, one has to remove that attachment to the material world. So it's for the reformation of the jivas. So it has nothing to do technically with the soul. It's just their attachment to it. It's not the natural inclination, right? The conditional situation, it addresses that, right? So that's why it's always this balance. So we'll get confused that if this, it means, since the one is just the mood, then, you know, that's what actually makes the devotional service function. The other one is you're giving up your attachment to the material world so that you can become attracted to Krishna, right? There's nothing distracting you from serving Krishna. So then, one has to be careful that one doesn't think that the renunciation is the devotional service. No, it's renouncing to connect to Krishna. And one shouldn't think that just because there is a, you know, one is happy doing something, there's a mood, therefore that happiness makes it devotional service. Does that make sense? So either by renunciation of regulation or by just the natural mood. Right? Because these are the distractions that the karmi and the jnanis have. Right? The sahajis and the maya bodies. One thinks it's the renunciation that's actually the dynamic principle. One thinks it's just the mood is the dynamic principle. Right? But it's mood towards Krishna and giving up a connection to the material world as service to Krishna. Right? This renunciation is the very means of liberation. Right? It means you're not going to get liberation other than renouncing, right? But that, but renunciation, as he's saying, is renunciation means renouncing the fruit, right? That's what it is. Renunciation doesn't mean going out and standing out in the rain or something like that. It's also a way of doing it. If by doing that you'll become detached from the material endeavor, then one does that. But otherwise, that's without giving due attention to renunciation, there will be hardly any possibility of progress because of the material attachments of the jiva. Because progress means, the progress isn't judged by how much you're becoming detached as much as by how much you're becoming attached to Krishna. Right? It means you can judge by knowledge and detachment. That's one of the ways to tell, because we're used to that. Right? Karma and jnana make sense to us. So when there's knowledge about Krishna and detachment from Maya, then we can tell there's advancement. You know, because actually understanding attachment to Krishna, that we don't, you know, really understand at this point. Right? When you get to Ruchi, then there's a big dawning of that. And what Asakti, then it has some meaning. Advancement in devotional service is often signified by symptoms such as tears, tremoring, sweating, etc. But these signs on their own are not proof of genuine devotional emotions. Right? Because someone can also just have them some, from either from some emotional, you know, some physical, I mean, excuse me, some material interaction it can generate, or it can be that they feign them. Right? The sahajas are very good at them. But these signs on their own are not proof of genuine devotional emotions. They can be caused by material attachments as well. Therefore, unless the devotional cultivation is observed along with renunciation, These shadowy reflections will occupy the heart, and genuine divine love will not be manifest there. So they go together. One's attraction to Krishna is happening as you're becoming detached from Maya. You can't be fully attached to Krishna and fully attached to Maya. Right? People will present it like that. You know, you're religionists, you're more all these, but it's not reality. Since renunciation automatically follows all devotional activities, a question may be asked, what is the need for making a distinction between renunciation and devotional activities, right? Because you perform devotional activities, renunciation will come, so why make the distinction? Right? Because they both go together. The answer is that although all devotional activities include renunciation, not all types of renunciation include devotion. So that's where we have to be able to distinguish. Otherwise, we think that just because we're very renounced, that it's devotional. No, just maybe, you know, attractive for you or easy for you. Yeah, because of that. So it may be, you know, very... one devotee, it's very easy for him to be detached from prasad or dressing or how he keeps his stuff, and he seems very renounced, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's devotional, since it is, prasad is Krishna, so you don't renounce Krishna, you only accept how much is required. You know, you're dressing for Krishna, the stuff you have is Krishna's, not yours. So it's mine, I'm renounced, so I don't take care of it, or I renounced about from my family, I don't take care of them, so I'm very advanced. Like this. These are just material concepts. So that's why it says the renunciation doesn't necessarily include devotion. Devotion includes renunciation, right? So here in logic, then this will be defined as that your explanation only works one direction, right? Because you have it one that doesn't work any direction, or one that works one way or the other, or that works both. Right? So the one that doesn't work, that's drop. Just like where there's smoke, there's fire. But where there's fire, there's not necessarily smoke. Right? Fire is the cause of smoke. But smoke doesn't have to produce fire. So this connection between devotional service and renunciation is the same. Devotional service will always generate knowledge and detachment. But knowledge and detachment does not... does itself generate devotional service, right? Because devotional service is beyond anything material. It has no cause. So causes in this world are knowledge and activity, right? So karma and jnana. So it's not based on that. It's based simply on its own self, the desire to please Krishna. That's all that drives it, right? But because our, you know, conditioned response to material attachments distract us from that natural attraction to Krishna that is in the constitutional position. Therefore, renunciation is useful. You know what I'm saying? The pot is, you want to cook with it. So the pot's only being properly used when you're cooking in it. But if the pot's dirty, you can't cook in it. So you have to wash it. So washing technically is not part of cooking. Right? Does that make sense? There is no washing while you're cooking. You can't wash the pot while you're cooking in the pot. It's not necessary. But it's only because it's dirty. So because we're conditioned, the pot has to be washed. Does that make sense? But in this case, you can be cooking and washing at the same time. But the emphasis will be more on the washing and less on the cooking, or more on the cooking, less on the washing. You understand? So devotional service can progress while we're even giving up. That's why devotional service is superior. Because the material platform, you can only do one thing at a time. Right? One sense can work at one time. You can't have many working. Right? It can move back and forth, but only one at a time. Right, but the spiritual platform is not confined by these restrictions. So devotional service can work also, but it's not going to be dynamic until, you know, there's a good amount of detachment from the material. Does this make sense? Right. So this conclusion is very important. Where there's devotion, there's automatically renunciation. Right? If there isn't renunciation, there is no devotion. Right? So you can see devotion by renunciation. Right? But you can't, by renunciation, you can't necessarily see devotion. Right? So in other words, if they're showing devotional tendencies and renunciation is there, then you know there's a strong connection. Right? But if they're showing, you know, strong tendency renunciation, it doesn't necessarily mean it's devotional. Right? So you can see, let's say a new person comes, shows all kinds of devotional sentiments, but there's no renunciation, so you know it won't last. So there is the festival, they're fired up, but then next time you meet them, then you know they're not as enthusiastic. Right? But if they keep that up, that enthusiasm, devotional service will generate the detachment. It will come. But just because they're becoming more and more detached doesn't mean they'll become more and more devotional. Yes. There is the possibility also, so in that case you have to look at other symptoms, you know, like that. You'd have to see, well, you know, how do they deal with those things of what we call attached? You know, what happens if it's lost? You know, and that example of what we told of the wrestler servant of Ramanujacharya. When half of his wife's gold was taken, he became angry that she acted in such a way, thinking it was her gold, so that they didn't take all of it. Right? So then you can tell that, you know, it's, they have facility, but they're not attached to it. You know, or you had Pundarik Vidyaniti, right? Gadadhar Pandit's guru. So he looked like it. You know, a total absolute sense enjoyer. But then when he mentioned something from Bhagavatam, just a few words, and he fell off the ground and was rolling around in ecstasy. Yeah, and just, you know, breaking things and all that, because if he was just making a show and he was attached, he wouldn't break anything. Like that. So therefore you could see from that. Yeah. Now let us see what is the meaning of devotional culture as explained in the next sutra, Sutra 35. Shravana kirtanadini paranu shilano payogivat pratyangani. Hearing and chanting of the divine narrations, etc., are the feature of devotional performances which help the cultivation of divine love. Right. So here, devotional culture didn't mean yogurt.
A new brand, devotional?
Yeah, devotional culture, you know. So you can get it, you know, Danone sells it, you know, little things like that. Acidophilus, and a devotional culture, different things. Increasing digestion, increasing devotion, all these.
Apply only after boiling for pronunciation.
Yes, yes. Yes. Srila Prabhupada stresses the importance of hearing and chanting the glories of the Supreme Lord in his purport to Mantra 13. The simple way to worship the Supreme Lord in this age of disturbance is to hear and chant about his great activities. The mental speculators, however, think that the activities of the Lord are imaginary. Therefore, they refrain from hearing of them and invent some word jugglery without any substance to divert the attention of the innocent masses of people. Right, so he's mentioned, it's word jugglery without any substance. Means, basically speaking, there's nothing in these mental speculators' philosophy that actually has any substance. You know, it's basically just all mental speculation. Right? There's no substance. Means these main theories, the six main ones, they have some substance, but at the same time is substance in that is based on the Shastra. But these other ones, they're completely speculating even about how to put together that. you know, I'm saying, you know, if everything is illusion, that means you're speaking about the Supreme would be illusion also. So why speak? Mm-hmm. Right? You know, all these little things, so they don't, the mind is doesn't exist, so why would you use it to speculate? So basically, if you apply their philosophy, they're left with nothing, you know, which is their goal anyway. But it doesn't actually work. So it's completely just no substance. Right? The other ones, then, it has some validity up to a point. That's why I always say the path of the impersonalist and our path up to the point of liberation is the same. You're going to apply Naishkarmya and understand the energies, potencies of the Lord like this. But once you get to liberation, then they stop and we continue. So this path of renunciation of the material world is the same. But they don't go beyond that point because the intent of devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead doesn't exist. So therefore, their renunciation is not classified as devotional service. Instead of hearing of the activities of Lord Krishna, such pseudo-spiritual masters advertise themselves by inducing their followers to sing about them. In modern times, the number of such pretenders has increased considerably. And it has become a problem for the pure devotees of the Lord to save the masses of people from the unholy propaganda of these pretenders and pseudo-incarnations. I think Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur mentioned. They were saying something about Radhakund. Said before there were a few, you know, Babaji's there, meaning the six Goswamis. He says now there's so many, you know, like that. So.
Can we say that it is like the this Naishkarmya part of bhakti which elevates us up to liberation?
On one sense, you could say that it's the Naishkarmya element that's elevating one, but it's actually the Naishkarmya allows that the devotion can elevate you. You know what I'm saying? Because we don't have that renunciation and that intellectual focus to elevate ourselves to liberation. You know, that they possibly could in other ages. You know? So, but even then, it's just that happens easy for them. It's the devotion that takes beyond. So even those who have that renunciation, and that comes natural for them, they won't put any emphasis on it as soon as they come in contact with devotional service. Because they're so expert to renunciation and get results, they can tell the difference. Like the four Kumaras can tell the difference. You know, they walked around, they smelled things and this, but they're not attached to anything, they're not attracted. It's not that their senses don't work. The four Kumaras are moving around the universe. They don't bump into, you know, demigods flying, you know, their airplanes. You know, why not? Because they have eyes, they can see. But they're not attached to what they see. They're not attached to what they smell or taste or touched. But when they smelled the tulsi at the lotus feet of the Lord, they became attracted. So they know they're totally detached. So how is it we're attracted? That must mean that it's spiritual, because we're only attracted by Brahman. So this Brahman has, you know, smell. So this is something new, and it's more attractive than the Brahman without smell. Right, that's that, yeah. Somebody says, like here you have gold, you know, so it's nice. But on the heavenly planets, it smells. It has a good fragrance.
The
gold itself has a fragrance on the heavenly planets. So more nice, right? So you can tell the difference. Right? If I gave you earthly gold and heavenly gold, would you be able to tell the difference?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So that's the point. The Upanishads indirectly draw our attention to the primeval Lord, Sri Krishna. But the Bhagavad Gita, which is the summary of all the Upanishads, directly points to Sri Krishna. Right? This is the difference. The Upanishads are pointing it out, but because it's indirect, that's why it's called aparavidya. Right? Because it's pointing it out through that there's you know, the Brahman and that, and then there's the Supreme Person, but it's not exactly directly talking about that surrender and devotion. Right? It gives the indication, but it doesn't actually directly do it. That's why even the Upanishads on that level are counted within the Vedanta. I mean within the Veda. Right? The point they're trying to make about connection to the Supreme Lord and the transcendence, that's the Vedanta, that's the transcendental. But the indirect aspect, so that's why Gita, that will be taken as directly Paravidya. Right? So does that make sense? Yes.
But it seems that there are not so many books who are really direct Paravidya.
There's not so many books that are direct. Yeah, that was Narad Muni's complaint. Is the incarnation of the Lord's writing ability hadn't written many. In fact, hadn't written any. Right. Well, I mean, Gita's there, but still, as we said, 700 verses out of 1,000, you're going to get distracted. Like, because if I get, like Manu gives 30 verses explaining how the killing of animals according to sacrifice is not violence. Right? Because they're piety. The soul gets elevated. Right? It's working within all this. And that if one kills without sacrifice, that is violence. That's sin. Right? You'll go to hell for that. But there's no violence in the other. There's no sin. Right? But it's not talking about, and all this. So it'll talk about that, and then what animals are can be offered in sacrifice, because that means only those ones can be, engaged. So all the ones that people use nowadays, they're not the ones that you can engage. Right? And so, you never hear of a porcupine burger or something like that. But, that would be, that's but that's after it's offered in sacrifice. You understand? So these different things like this, and so much is there. Then at the very end, it points out that someone who their whole life if they live 100 years and are a vegetarian, and someone in their life does 100 ashrameda yagyas, you get the same benefit, right? And if you think about it, the origin of flesh is quite funky, right? It's not like some clean earth and a nice little seed, right? Sperm and ovum, it's funky, right? And not only that, there's no sin, but there's a reaction, right? Mung saha. Mum, I kill you, saha, you kill me. And it ends with that. So all these verses have explained all the different things of what animal and this and that. But at the end, there's these three verses that say, don't get involved. But people don't notice those three. They notice the other 27. So that's Narad Muni's point, is that they're not going to notice the Gita. They're going to notice the other, and the proportion is much greater, We're talking about 10%, but here 700 to 100,000 is not 10%. Yeah. So it's a problem. So that's why the Bhagavatam is direct. Right? It means the Vedanta Sutra is direct. Like that. But then it'll be hard to understand because it's being a sutra. So it'll require commentary, it'll require example. So the Bhagavatam is the natural commentary because it expands on the points and gives the example together. Right? So it makes it accessible to everyone. Well, Vedanta Sutra, if one is very academic, then it becomes accessible. Yeah.
He's describing the Bhagavatam that in Dravari's position, because he did 100 Ashwamedha sacrifice.
Who?
Indra.
Uh-huh.
So he was so afraid that Prithu would do the same thing. We hear of certain activities like to go around Govardhan Hill. I think I've heard it's the equivalent of 10 Ashwamedha sacrifice. Or like you were mentioning, to be vegetarian for one's own life. So
why isn't Indra worried about that?
Yeah. Why is it
So that means
may look like there's
so
a lot
so
of,
when the Babaji goes around Govardhan Hill 9 times, Indra's cool, but on the 10th time around, then when he gets to Apsarakun, watch out.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Is that what you're wondering?
Yeah, I'm wondering about that.
Well, because the person who's doing the devotional activity, they're not interested in heavenly pleasures, but the person who's doing the Ashwamedha Yajna is. So therefore, he doesn't have to worry about that. Does that make sense? Right? So from his side, that would be the point. But from the devotee's side, even say it's worth 10 Ashwamedha Yajnas, that still doesn't count. But it just gives you an idea. There's an Ashwamedha Yajna. Only the big, big kings could organize one, you know, or to do a few of them. You know, so to do more is very rare. But here is that, you know, all that trouble, all that piety. But the piety is more. It's just to give you an idea. Just like when we say, you know, you want millions of years, that's just to give an idea. You know, or the unlimited ocean, that still doesn't. You know, as said before, is that the devotee, when he comes to the platform of prema, then he's thinking all those examples that I gave, they're so far from, you know, the reality of the experience. But, you know, so he's saying, I'm sorry that I compared you like that. You know? Because in this world, you see a nice cloud and that, you know, it has that romantic element, so it sounds very poetic and nice. Krishna's like this. But he says, when you actually see Krishna, that doesn't have any meaning anymore. You know what I'm saying? Is that what you're... Therefore, one should hear about Krishna as he is by hearing from the Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. And in this way, one's mind will gradually be cleansed of all contaminated things. Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.17 says, by hearing the activities of the Lord, the devotee draws the attention of the Lord. Thus, the Lord, being situated in the heart of every living being, helps the devotee by giving him proper directions. In Bhagavad Gita 10.10 confirms this, Dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayanti te. Does that make sense? So technically speaking, you could actually say, in reality, there's one, you know, transcendental literature, that's Bhagavatam. And all the other literatures are written in pursuance of, you know, what's given in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So the commentaries of the Acharyas, all these other works that they do on studies on Bhagavatam, the Gita is like the introduction. Right, Chaitanya Charitamrita is like applying it for our specific situation, which right now is very noisy. We're in a 10-minute break. Prabhupada said, class, you run the classes on an hour, so 50-minute class, 10-minute break. So in 10 minutes they can run around, yell, scream, this, that, and then they'll be able to sit for 50 minutes more, you know. So before we didn't allow that, you know, it's just the class ended, the next class and all that, but it works. If you're not trying to see, because now no one else upstairs is having a class, so it works, right? You know, so okay.
You should see us between classes here.
Okay. Same thing, right? Kids are in for some competition. Okay. The Lord's inner direction cleanses the devotee's heart of all contamination produced by the material modes of passion and ignorance. Non-devotees are under the sway of passion and ignorance. One who is in passion cannot become detached from material hankering, and one who is in ignorance cannot know what he is or what the Lord is. Right, so knowledge and detachment you can't actually have if the modes of passion and ignorance are there. Right, because mode of goodness is based on knowledge and detachment. Right, so that's why it's considered superior. Right, if you can situate yourself in the mode of goodness, it's superior because knowledge and detachment come very easily. But if you situate yourself in passion and ignorance, then even though you're doing devotional service, it will be very, it'll be much harder to affect the knowledge and renunciation that's going to liberate you from the material energy, right? Mm. And it'll be very hard to think about Krishna. You're distracted. On the mode of goodness, you're not distracted. That's its advantage, but it's only it's because it's connected to Krishna. It's not something to cultivate separately. Thus, when one is in passion or ignorance, there's no chance for self-realization. However much one may play the part of a religionist. For a devotee, the modes of passion and ignorance are removed by the grace of the Lord. In this way, the devotee becomes situated in the quality of goodness, the sign of a perfect Brahmana. Anyone can qualify as a Brahmana if he follows the path of devotional service under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master, right? We talk about here, the proper thing is the Brahmana is the mentality, right? Then there's a natural occupation that goes with that. So here, this Brahmana doesn't mean the aspect of the occupation that one has on the material platform, right? So it means what is the situation. Brahman is situated in goodness, right? Kshatriya in passion and goodness. Vaishya in passion and ignorance. Shudra in ignorance. One's situated in goodness. So one is able to hear, one is able to study, one is able to do all those things. Is that what's up? Right. So that means anyone can be brahminical. So that means the devotee can, but it doesn't mean the occupation. Right? We should all, it means anybody can do an arti because they be, you know, they can have that consciousness and that. But can anybody do puja all day, every day? No. If that was the case, why would it be so hard, you know, out of tens of thousands of devotees to have regular pujaris, right? Regular cooks for the temple, right? Someone to always go out and regularly do the preaching, right? Because it's not their condition nature. It's not so they're not brahminical by condition nature. But any of those they could do, right? So that's why, you know, the artik, anybody can do the artik, but generally, which artik do they want to do?
Evening one.
Evening one. Yeah, generally evening one. But then also you get good credit for the Mangal artik, you know, or Darshan artik. How many want to do the noon one, or 4 o'clock, or the 8:30 one at night?
On Sundays.
Okay, Sundays, when the Hindus show up, right?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You know what I'm saying? But you understand the point? So it comes, you know, doing the pujari work, okay. Taking down the backdrops, putting up the backdrops, washing the floor and all that. How many want to do that, right? How many want to dress the deity? You understand? Because everyone will notice that. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the difficulty. Right? You know, we'll fight over who gives the Bhagavatam class in the temple, but no one's talking about who's going to go down to the Bowery and talk to the bums there. You know, who's going out to the prison preaching? You know, who's going out into the congregation and talking to devotees there? There's no fight over that. Because you don't have to fight. There's plenty of space. You know, who's doing it? Right, so ones that will be recognized. So that's the difficulty, is the conditioned nature allows for certain things, but to be regular and beyond that, that takes the that purification. You know what I'm saying? So one doesn't have to worry about it, that one isn't interested to be a full-time Pujari if one is fully engaged. Right? So the consciousness is brahminical. That's what you're looking for. That's the point. Is we don't have to worry that everybody's going to be doing brahminical activities, meaning as an occupation. No, everyone's going to be brahminical by consciousness. Occupation, they're going to be whatever it is. That doesn't matter. Because all occupations are necessary. Right? Unless you want to live in the forest, then you don't have to worry about it. But I'm not, I mean, I haven't seen any forest yatras yet, right? We have enough trouble with farm, it's already got too much forest on it, right? Like that. And natural jungle also is not appreciated like that. So there's not much aboriginal preaching yatras like that. But you do have cement jungle. That is very popular. That one is the most popular of all.
Maharaj Samaka tried a farm in the middle of Amazon, but it closed down.
Yeah, it just grows in so much. They come looking for the devotees and they find them all tied up and all the creepers and all that. You know?
You have to carry your machete to Mangalarti.
Yeah. Just wasn't here yesterday.
There are lots of crocodiles by the way.
So, oh, okay.
Leopards many times and giant snakes. So the locals are a bit scared.
I guess that's why the locals keep moving. Right? Right? That's far out.
When you speak about brahminical consciousness, it's like a step toward pure devotion.
Brahminical consciousness, is it a step to pure devotion? Yes, means because brahminical means they're situated in goodness, so we're trying to get to pure goodness. So the knowledge and detachment will bring one to that goodness. And as we continue, that will bring us to pure goodness. When that surrender to Krishna is first, you know, rather than after, then you get pure devotion, right? So it's the natural. So the occupation doesn't have to change. That's why many examples are given of different situations in life where they don't have to change their occupation. You know, the Pandavas and everybody else like that, you know. And there's a lot of rules and regulations on the occupation itself, like the brahminical. But you can be just as much a devotee, right? But like in business, there's very few regulations, right? So it's even easier. You know? The point is the profit. That's the whole, the profit and what you sell, like that. Basically, that's your only restrictions. You make profit, otherwise you can't call it a business. And then within the business, what you're dealing in. You know, so what's authorized. Does that make sense? Yes.
When some ISKCON preachers state that due course of advancement, occupation also changes, how much substance is...
How much substance? It means... One can change the occupation if, due to conditioned life, the covering of ignorance is so great, due to lack of association. Because just like you have a Brahmana, but then you have a Brahma Bandhu, which means someone who technically is brahminical by character, I mean by occupation or nature, but by character is not. They're like a Shudra by character, but brahminical by nature. You understand? So they're going to act like a Shudra. So you have a Brahma Bandhu, a Kshatriya Bandhu, a Vaishya Bandhu. Vaishya Bandhu, Jagatpati. Yeah, so, you know, you understand? So the point is if that's the case, then when someone comes in by performing devotional service, it will uncover and they'll go back to that position. But if their position is, you know, whatever that is, that's not going to change. It's not that Arjuna at the beginning of Gita was a Kshatriya, at the end of the Gita he became a Brahmin. No, that was his suggestion in the first chapter. Krishna somehow or another didn't appreciate it, right? Maybe he wasn't liberal enough or, you know, join a more democratic, you know, how you say, political party to appreciate that, or he went to the wrong school, right? You know,
be all we can be.
Yeah, yeah, you know. What's that one famous university in France? You know, all the revolutionaries come out of there. Oh, yeah. So he didn't go there, you know. He went to Sami Pani Muni's ashram.
This is life.
Huh?
This is life.
Yes, what to do, what to do, you know. Okay? So that will happen, but the nature won't change, you know, once it gets to that purified state. You know, so I've seen it with kids. They come in and they go through, you know, what you think guys shoot, and he comes up and he's a, I had one kid, he was so rough in the school, and that I thought he's not going to make it in the school, but he was big, so he got an opportunity to go out on the Sankirtan and all that, so I sent him on that rather than running with the rest, because all the other kids were like, the oldest were like 12 or something like that, so he was way older than the others. And then, you know, 10 years down the line, then he's one of the main Nisringa Pujaris and has been that way for the last 10 or 15 years. So it's just a matter of association, so the covering is there. Does that make sense? You know, but others, you know, in the school, they look like a Vaishya, and when they grow up, they're still one. You know, like that. So you get that also. So you get, it doesn't... Does that make sense? So what we're looking for is a change in consciousness, this idea that, no, the occupation changes, no. Because for us, going to the temple and doing artik for Guru Puja or cooking for the deities on a festival day, this is Vaishnava activities, part of sadhana. It's not an occupation. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's where then it has to be seen, is that, let's say, like samskars. Samskars aren't a way of making money. It's a facility to see that the community is purifying themselves and their children. But when it's approached from the way of money, that's Vaishya, and that's what they shouldn't be doing. Right? That's why the devotees who do that, you don't see them doing that generally for more than 6 months. You know? Or after 6 months, they're not doing for the temple anymore, they're doing for themselves. And then after a few years, you hardly hear them doing that at all. You know what I'm saying? Because it's not a business. Doesn't mean people don't give donations, you don't make money. But it's not seen as a business. Right? So, therefore, these distinctions are made. You say, oh, anything for preaching. Yes, but within the culture. Nature and character. Here we were taking nature meaning the occupational skills, and character we were meaning the quality of the the quality of their understanding of right and wrong. You understand? Nature will be, you could say, in this case, to give an example, nature would be ethics, while character would be morality. Does that mean anything? Yeah, like that. Because what is right and wrong in the skill, right? That's niti, and that's, you know that this is what you do. But what we mean here, character, means what's good and bad. You know what I'm saying? Because it may be in ethics okay, you know, certain business tactics. But as far as good and bad goes, it's not good. It's good business, but it's not moral. You understand? So you can separate them. So that's why we make the distinction of what is the character, what it is the nature. But then the point is by engaging in devotional service, it's purified. So naturally the character comes along with it. But the nature is going to be the same. Right? Does that make sense? The person is going to protect other people. That's how he's going to make his money. You know? So he could be, you know, working in the government and stuff like that. But instead, you know, he runs a gang. And he takes care of everyone in the gang. You know what I'm saying? So one is not very... One is not very pure, and the other one is more pure. You know what I'm saying? We're talking in an idyllic situation. You know? Reality, it might be the other way around. Right? You know, something like that. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Yeah.
Guna.
How did it fit? Guna is, means with.
With nature and character.
Karma is the work you can do, so that's your skill. The guna will be the character you have. See, that's the problem is that when you have had Varna Shankara, right? Like a Nishada, they have the technically the you could say the karma of a Brahman, but the guna of a Shudra. So that's bad. You know what I'm saying? But it's like that. You can only do so much bad with a Shudra mentality, because the emotions and other things, it's not as focused. So you can only be so bad, right? But a Chandala, that's the other way around. You know, so it's a Shudra karma, Brahminical guna. So then you can really apply your brains into being bad. You understand? So that's why it's considered worse.
Does that do around the Kajipu?
Not, I mean, see, he performed his Kshatriya duties nicely.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's not the point. There, that's just divine and demoniac. So you could say as a character would be the divine and the demoniac element. Right? And the nature would be what would be this particular way that occupationally you would maintain yourself. Is that what it is?
So in other words, when we purify the soul, the guna is elevated.
Yeah, the character is elevated, but it doesn't change the condition. Your conditioned nature doesn't change, but your being attached to and identifying with the conditioned nature, that changes. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, let's say you have a house, okay? And you can do certain things in your house, right? So you have facility. Now, or another example is your body, okay? Now your body, you have a certain amount of strength, you know, certain amount of emotional, intellectual capacity, right? Now, when you become a devotee, that strength doesn't change, or the amount of intellectual capacity doesn't change, or you know, that the mind is more emotional, that doesn't change. It becomes purified. You understand? So instead of sitting and reading all kinds of, you know, novels all day, now you read Bhagavatam all day. Or instead of doing all kinds of physical activities, now you do physical activities for Krishna. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So we say that nature is what potential is there, and character is how you use that potential.
Not necessarily, because the character is the quality of being more pious or less pious. Here, when it means what we've been defining nature, because meaning that what is your occupational skill? Does that make sense? That's all. Like you can have, let's say, a government officer. He sits at a desk somewhere. He could have good character and not take bribes and do his job nicely. You know, let's say he's an accountant. Then he does his accounts. Another one has the same accountancy qualification, but his character is not good. So he's always taking bribes and, you know, not doing as much work as he can and stuff like that. Does that make sense? So the skill doesn't change. Maybe it would be easier to look at it this way. The nature, what we're talking about here, is the varna. And the level of purification could be seen in ashram. You know what I'm saying? The quality of your sadhana, the quality of your personal dealings with others, like that. Does that make sense? Okay, summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary. The unalloyed state of the devotional sentiment is called prema, divine love. This divine love manifested in the purified mind is called bhava. This bhava itself is the manifestation of divine love in the conditioned state of the jivas. Physical activities cultured according to this divine love natured bhava are known as devotional performances, sadhana. Devotional performances devoid of devotional sentiments are not conducive to devotion. Pigeons living in the temple are fishes living in the Ganga. Okay, so the unalloyed devotion is prema. Remember, we were discussing before that love, where it's applied, it takes on that, we give it that definition. Right? So in the same way, the natural sentiment on its own, prema, that's divine love. Now when it's applied into the mind, the purified mind, right, then that's called bhava. Right? Because you're still dealing on the mental platform of meditation that the service is going on in that state. Right? So there's still that contemplation, there's still the practice element. Though it's very high, so it's called bhava. It's not, you generally don't define it. It's not, it's separate from sadhana. Now when the physical body is being used, right? So then that's called sadhana. So that can be the physical on the platform of bhava, where you're getting adjusted with your form, learning the duties of that form. But it also would mean here that we're engaging the body, you know, in line with that the mind, purified mind, is engaged in devotional pursuit. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the devotional aspect. So that would be the sadhana. Right? So the sentiment has to be there, as you're pointing out. Otherwise, if the sentiment's not there, then pigeons also live in the temple. Fish are also swimming in the Ganga all day. They don't go anywhere else. Right? But it doesn't mean that it's devotional. Right? They may get purified, but it's not devotion.
What goal says that?
What?
Goal, the Christian goal.
Okay.
Says that works.
Not the bear. Oh, that's poop. Okay, go.
When he says that faith.
You can get them mixed up.
Yeah. Faith and work without faith has no value.
Work without faith. Yeah.
And then the new Protestant basically just believe in Jesus and work has no value.
Yes.
But taking here, he's pointing out that the two go together. You do the activity, but the consciousness.
Consciousness has to be there. But of the two, it's the consciousness that's more important. Right? So between the faith and the work is more important. Right? So if you have the work without faith, it's useless. But the faith without the proper work to express it, then also means the faith hasn't developed that much. Because if it's just the sentiment, I'm doing it for Krishna and that's all, then we're more worried about the experience we get by expressing the faith than Krishna actually getting a good result. Right? Because that means more work and then it's less ecstasy for us. Right? Is that yeah. So it's not that people don't see something of value. The problem is they only get glimmers. You know, but it's like everything that everybody, all the, you know, quotations and history of any seeming, you know, have some meaning. But, you know, all that together still doesn't equal a part of Bhagavatam, you know. So it's nice. You can take these and they're, you know, it's like that one of books are the basis. Preaching is the essence. Utility is the principle. Preaching, purity is the force. I think that's actually from some variety of Chinese Buddhist monk. Right? You know, so it's a good point. It matches the situation. So he must have a similar situation. That's how it works. So these things have value because they're in support of of, you know, something given, you know, from the Shastra, like that. So then they have a value. But then that's where it ends. It's not now everything that, you know, Poe says has some meaning. Does that make sense? So, you know, that one thing, then, hey, great. If the devotees can use it, then he gets some benefit. So you go around, you're going to do, how you say, dead poet Sankirtan. Right? Go through all the quotes of all these dead poets and then see what's useful and then work them into your lectures, and this way then they all get purified. What preaching do you do, Prabhu? Oh, I preach the benefit dead poets. Yeah. We started the Dead Poet Society, right? Really? Can I join? Sorry, you're too young. Too many life symptoms here. Okay. When a devotee is engaged in devotional performances, both his mind and soul are illuminated with bhava and praying. In this way, the devotional performance itself is the cultivation of divine love. Therefore, when the word sadhana is mentioned, it includes the principles of bhava and praying in it. Because it's a descending process, so it already includes the higher. Right? Just like when you're building up from the bottom, the foundation doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything above it. Right? But in the Vedic, it starts from the foundation and descends. So the principle is already there. Right? And then all the detail. Does that make sense? So you're performing the activity. So the engagement, the activity, the experience is coming from that. Right? So that's the bhava element is there. And then that desire to please Krishna and do it just for Krishna, that's the prema element. But it's filtering through our conditioning. So therefore it's called sadhana bhakti, right? As it becomes more purified, and the element of trying to please Krishna is there, then it becomes bhava bhakti. When it's more, it becomes prema bhakti. Right? So does that make sense? The devotional performances are of two types: esoteric, raganuga, and what is it? Esoteric and esoteric. What is there?
Exoteric.
Esoteric is raganuga and exoteric is regulated. Regulated by scriptural rules and called sadhana. These esoteric devotional performances are to be followed as... it's probably supposed to be the exoteric. As long as the devotional... are to be followed as long as devotional sentiments are manifest. These rules are described by the sages. Attainment of devotional attachment to the Supreme Lord is the real award of following these rules. Yeah, okay. But I mean, just taking it, we can take it. The esoteric, if the sentiment is there, then the esoteric element will be there. But as soon as that devotional sentiment's not there, then it goes back to the rules. You know, you're in the kirtan, it's going to static, devotees are doing all kinds of crazy things, backflips and this and that, and singing funny ways and dancing and all that. As that spontaneous mood is there, then it doesn't matter, it's going on. That nourishes itself. Right? When the kirtan's over the next day and everybody's half asleep, then it's rules that's going to govern. You know what I'm saying? So it's going to happen anyway. Right? So the exoteric will mean that your regulation is there. So that's the form. But the point is those on the esoteric always are expert at following the exoteric. And the ones that are exclusively on the exoteric means exclusively meaning there's less of the esoteric manifest. Because the point is esoteric is the devotional element. Right? But you regulate it through the exoteric so that you are engaged in it, right? Because the exoteric makes sure that you're detached from the material world and engaged in activities that would be called the piety of devotional service, right? So things that are unfavorable are rejected, things that are favorable are accepted. So it sees that you're doing, you're properly situated on the platform of the renunciation. Right? So that the esoteric can manifest. But that's the whole process. It's just that if there's more prominence of the esoteric, it's called Raganuga. Not that it's a different thing. People try to make it into a different sadhana. But that means if they're doing that, then they are situated on the exoteric platform. Right? They're just trying to create a new thing. Like that. Does that make sense? You know, and so then when you get up to the platform of bhava, then you don't have the exoteric. Because on the transcendental platform, there is no difference between the two. Right? The spiritual body and the soul are non-different. So the activities of the body, the mind, the soul are the same. They're one thing. So you don't have branches. Right? Yeah, like that. You know, like the stores, we have no branch. You know, so devotional service doesn't have a branch. Right? It's not on that level. Among the 64 methods of sadhana, Srila Rupa Goswami has emphasized five as most important. 1. Delight in visualizing Sri Murti. 2. Faith on hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. 3. Association of devotees. 4. Hearing and chanting the holy name. And 5. Residing in the holy abodes of Mathura. So it's interesting because it delight in visualizing rather than just worshipping the deity, right? And faith on hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. You know, like that. So in other words, argumentative, you know, attitude, that's not what it's talking about. Association of the devotees. So the dati prati grinati guhyamaki divitsi bhunte bojai, like that. In the next verse, the author describes the previously mentioned renunciation aspect of upaya bhakti. So this was the cultivation, right? So how do we cultivate means of upaya, the intent devotion, right? So that's through having the right attitude when you're performing the devotional activities, right? Right, so now he'll discuss the renunciation side, right? Because you always have, you start with the main principle, then it's subdivisions, describing those subdivisions, that you know that the aspect. Then you get into each one of them. Then they have divisions. Then you get into those. So you gradually go down. Right? Does that make sense? Sutra 30, yes.
To have the right attitude. Can we connect this with it was explained before that sincerity is the essential element.
Yes.
So right attitude means to maintain our sincerity to develop the vocation.
Yes, you could say the desire, yeah. Sincerity will be that you are without, you know, ulterior motive trying to progress. Like that, apply yourself. Like Brahma was actually sincerely trying to find the Supreme Lord. Right? He didn't have any other purpose to it. He wasn't, you know, trying to find him so he could say, okay, you've been doing this for a while. Can I do it for a while now? You know, so, you know, it was not something else, you know. Can you make my lotus a little bigger, you know? When I lay down, I kind of touch the petals and it's a little freaky. You know, like that. Is that... Deharatam manash sharatim indriya hayam astipya jnanena yukta vairagyena cha vishaya margach chaner nivartayed esha eva pratyahara. The physical body is the chariot, the mind is the charioteer, and the senses are the horses. Driving this chariot back to the divinity, away from the path part of worldly attachments, by the help of divine knowledge and balanced abnegation, is known as retraction. Balanced abnegation. Divine knowledge means material knowledge isn't what makes it work. It's divine knowledge. And balanced abnegation.
That means to see everything equal, like the Brahman vision.
Yeah, I mean, you're trying to get to that, the balanced vision, but also balanced abnegation would mean you're balanced in your renunciation. It's not extreme. Right? It means you do see in the Vedas extreme renunciation, but that comes with time. You know, like the Vanaprastha explains that's where you'll see extreme renunciation, generally speaking, is that they don't get involved because they're a hermit. They don't have to get involved. So if they stand out in the rain all day, you know, it doesn't bother, you know, they don't have to see anybody. They have no lecture to give. They have no you know, regulated, you know, worship to do. So they can do that. Right? But the others have more of a regulation. Right? Sannyasis could do that, but the point is they have better things to do. Right? So there, that renunciation is to completely remove any inclination or attachment to the mundane. Right? But it doesn't happen overnight. It's gradually. Right? You know, you go out and stand out in the rain and you make it for 5 minutes and that's all you do. You know, until you can just live outside and it doesn't matter if it's sun or rain or this or that. But in the beginning, one will have a shelter. But after years, one may not bother with the shelter anymore. If you built it, it falls down. So then, anyway, by the time it falls down, you don't need it anymore. You know what I'm saying? So it's balanced in how much you do, how much you can. Like yoga always says, you only do as much as you never force. You know, the breathing, you don't force. The asana, you don't force. If you do, it'll create a problem. You know? Does that make sense? Yeah. The switch from material to spiritual consciousness is accomplished by active devotional service. In the purport, right? So switching from one to the other, it's still active. So you're switching the consciousness. The activity is remaining the same. In the purport of Mantra 4, Srila Prabhupada writes, every part and parcel of the complete whole is endowed with some particular energy to act according to the Lord's will. When the part and parcel living entity forgets his particular activities under the Lord's will, he is considered to be in Maya, illusion. Thus, from the very beginning, Sri Upanishad warns us to be very careful to play the part designated for us by the Lord. This does not mean that the individual soul has no intuitive initiative of his own, because he is part and parcel of the Lord. He must partake of the initiative of the Lord as well. When a person properly utilizes his initiative or active nature with intelligence, right, that understanding that everything is the Lord's potency, he can revive his original consciousness, which was lost due to association with Maya, the external energy. Right, so the initiative is fine, but it has to be in line with how Krishna defines that initiative, how it's supposed to be used. So the individuality isn't lost. You know, some of you say, no, you just surrender, you just do this, that. But the point is that's okay in the beginning if one has no idea what to do. Right? One comes out with a crazy idea. You know, it's like, you know, well, I'll get on the roof and we'll put a bucket of water down there and, you know, I'll chant loudly, all the neighbors will come around, then I'll jump off into the bucket, you know, and won't get killed, and all the neighbors will therefore have faith that this chanting is something special and all that, so therefore then they'll all join. So no, you just do what you're told. You know, like that. So if one is able to see one's nature and see it in connection to Krishna, then that should be encouraged, that individual development. Does that make sense?
We see in a lot of our temples this element is lacking.
It's lacking. It's just a matter of not understanding. Because, see, it's having a whole bunch of unsurrendered people is difficult. Right? So since that's generally the case of the Kali Yuga, you know, and especially the Western lifestyle, then just generating submission is a great... Yes, but to bring it to the point of positive where everybody is able to, you know, how you say, devotionally self-inspired, then that's even more, that's dynamic. The other one's workable. Then you can create a regulated form of something that will work at a particular speed and get a particular result. So it's set. You know it's there. You know, you do this kind of sankirtan, you get this much books distributed, you get this much facility, you get this done, and it works. But if someone's able to inspire and go beyond that, then you can expand. So that's, but that will come with time as they get purified. But the point is the administrator, the leader should be able to see this. So in the beginning, when it will just get them to, you know, basically not be crazy, you know. But if they can engage their nature, like we see Prabhupada went to America. So who came first are the, you know, the...
crazy.
Yeah, but it's but at the same time is they're kind of like the intellectuals who are looking for these things. Because the common person is very absorbed in the Western... Malecha lifestyle. It was pretty standard. Yeah, you know, it's just very, very standard. So you had some that saw something was wrong there. But because it was an alternative lifestyle, then generally it was always mixed with, you know, that so it's the element of the mind, you know, the speculation, the intellect, but the mind trying to see something more gentle. Then the mind also gives rise to your finer element of the mind also gives rise to arts. So it's very natural you a lot of times see this arts and intellectualism combined, you know, but more of a speculative, you know, kind of like that. And so then that class was the first to notice, you know, but like you said, most likely the most fallen because they're not following authority, they're working on their own intelligence and everything like that. So, and so they would come, they'd do the music and this and that. Then Prabhupada had that loft, and they had, like, puts up, you know, hung a few blankets in the corner. Because the lofts are like a warehouse, because that's what they were for originally. They were factories, and then when they became converted, then artists used the lofts. So you could get this huge loft. And so they just would put up some blankets, so there were no walls in them. And then that corner was Prabhupada, and some people came to see. And they came in, and there's all pictures around the walls of, you know, different this and that with the Indian kind of stuff, and people are all sitting in front of them doing something, you know, meditating or doing this and that or whatever they're doing. And they're thinking, oh wow, this is what they do here. So when they came in to see Prabhupada, then he asked Prabhupada, so, you know, you meditate, and says, nah, what they're doing, I have no idea they're doing that. That's what they want to do, you know. Because we do kirtan, you know, we discuss. So his point is they're taking part in the kirtan, and then if they can engage their nature, nice. And so as time went, then different people could do different things. Like Satsarup, because he worked in the government level, he could do all these official things, like, you know, get the society registered and things like that. You know, so different people did different things. You know, so he would be looking out for that. But if they went off course, then it's a matter of surrendering, you know, like that. But if not, if it's connected to Krishna, then... sense. So gradually. If you look like that, then you can get a wide range of activities. But if you want everybody to just fit into this kind of thing, some will fit, a lot won't. Most won't. Because if most fit, they'd all be in the temples. Right? Because it's harder to fit into the material world.
So it's a lack of broad-mindedness.
It's just a lack of probably understanding what you could get. You're looking at efficiency, but they don't understand that you'll get more efficiency.
No.
Yeah, but at the same time, is then it's a different kind of authority. You have to be able to be an authority by, you know, that vision, as opposed to just being managerially expert. Like that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. On an individual basis, this principle you mentioned here, the initiative, is that process of manana you mentioned that you...
initiative, manana.
You apply, you contemplate, you apply it.
Yes, you could say.
Then you be...
You could say, yeah. Because the manana is going to... The initiative in manana means initiative is going to come from contemplation. but it could be either contemplation in the way of the understanding of the philosophy, the application into your own sadhana, your personal development, or into an activity. I mean activity meaning that you wouldn't necessarily consider sadhana, you know, but it's part of the preaching or part like this. So it could be any of those, but the point is unless you contemplate, so the thing is to be thoughtful. That's the difference, is that if you're thoughtful, you think. But for many, thinking can be dangerous. They can come up with all kinds of very strange and wonderful things. So for them, you want them to focus more on applying the physical, you know, applying the body and the senses and engaged in activities. Then as they become purified, then the mind will be more fixed. So then that contemplation will be very good for them. So that's why you always create an environment where they're always busy. So if they happen to think of something not connected, it doesn't matter because they're already busy doing devotional activity. But at the same time, as if from doing that being physically engaged, if they contemplate something, you know, connection to Krishna, then that's a greater benefit. So it's just a matter of finding what will work. You know, the freedoms are good if they'll use them properly. Does that make sense? Okay. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is somewhere. The body here is called the chariot because it is controlled by the mind. The mind is called the charioteer because it controls the senses. The senses are called the horses because they pull the chariot, the body, here and there. Right? So through senses, you move. Right? Movement or time is affected through the senses. Right? The mind controls the senses. The body is the chariot. The body moves by the senses. The mind controls the senses. So that means the mind is controlling the chariot. I'm saying either way you take it, but the point is what controls the horses. So here he just says the mind. The mind is the charioteer. Because it controls the intelligence, it controls the senses. Right? Because the intelligence the intelligence engages the senses according to the direction of the mind. Right? Does that make sense? So when the mind's not purified, then one will drive the senses in a material direction. When the mind's purified, it'll drive it in a spiritual direction.
So in this example of the intelligence state, the position of attraction in the mind.
Sorry?
In this example, would the intelligence, would it be as attraction within the mind?
Such a forceful voice. We should have him sit on the roof or something.
I'm trying to see where is the position of the intelligence in this example. Could you please help me explain?
He says, you're driving away from worldly attachment by the help of divine knowledge and balanced abnegation. So that's intelligence.
Driving would be the
Do you understand the Gita example? So what is the intelligence doing? It's driving, but through what?
Through the mind.
Right. So the point is what makes the horses go this way and that way?
The mind through the
mind. The identity.
Means the reins are doing it.
Yeah.
Right? So the point is here, it's just all put together because the mind includes the intelligence and the false ego. So it's just a matter of it's broken up or not. So if it's not mentioned, the intelligence, that means the intelligence is already included in the mind. Okay? Because he's not making a distinction here between the reins and this and that. Is that okay? Okay. Okay. So we'll continue with this tomorrow. Oh, it's a big one, this one.
Big one.
Mm-hmm.
Surprise.
Yes, big one. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samar Veta Bhakti Vrindaki, Jainatai Gaura Prenarayana.